I can't tell you the number of people who come to me said, I did not know this about you after they'd read the book. And I was like, well, I didn't exactly share it, you know, and I didn't know that I wanted to share it, honestly, but I felt better for the sharing.
Welcome to Daring to Tell, the podcast where writers read their true stories of personal daring, and then we talk about writing and life. I am Michelle Rado.
Nothing's gonna make me brave. Nothing's gonna make me brave. Nothing's gonna make me brave except doing what makes me scared.
As I was making the final tweaks on getting this episode ready to send off to you, the Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance announced their book award finalists for 2023. In the category of memoir, Blue Butterfield, Maine, A Love Story. One of four in that category. And if you have walked into pretty much any independent bookstore in Maine, you have seen this book. It has been on the nonfiction bestseller list here, usually in the top position, pretty much from the moment it was released in 2023. It's a hardcover book of full color, glossy woodcut prints. The colors are stunning. And in each picture, you can feel Blue's love and reverence for the places she depicts. From rocky coastlines down east, through woodsy hiking or biking paths, to vistas looking out over Katahdin, the state's highest mountain, to autumn farmers markets in Portland. It is hard to pick a favorite among them, but the one at the very front of the book is called, I'm not sure how to say this, Astiku Azalea Gardens in Northeast Harbor. In the foreground, there is the back of a girl sitting on a rock bench. She's wearing a simple bluish summer dress. Her legs are crossed, and she's leaning a little bit to the right. A book is held open with her right hand. The scene she is sitting in front of is a calm harbor inlet surrounded by lush greens of late summer and warm reds and oranges of early autumn. And when I stare at it long enough, tears come to my eyes for the beauty of it, for the comfort and the solitude of that moment and that girl in that place, alone, focused on a book, in the middle of all this beauty. Because I was so captivated by the art, it took me a little while to adjust my focus to her words, because among and between all of these pictures are personal essays, equally compelling, where Blue shows scenes and moments, both beautiful and difficult, where she grew up. And because of the beauty, I found it harder to focus my attention on the difficult parts, because as I've listened back to our conversation, there was a word I think I danced around when talking with her. Poverty. Why so hard to focus on this tough ingredient in this setting? I don't know. Maybe it's me. I think maybe it also has to do with juxtapositions of what the poverty is surrounded by. And as I see and discover more and more in the many memoirs I read, our stories are never just one thing. So before we get into our conversation today, I did want to read you just the opening paragraph from Maine, A Love Story. It is called, If You Give a Girl an Outhouse. If you offer a 52-year-old woman a last visit to her childhood home in rural Maine before it is sold, she will say, no, I think not. She will remember a dirt road of potholes to get to the house and deer flies that chased her on the long walk home from the school bus stop. A house without electricity or even, for a time, indoor plumbing. A house without siblings, without wall-to-wall carpeting and television and all the conveniences of her friends' houses in town. She will remember isolation and powerlessness and boredom. She will remember a childhood of wants and needs not met. So here we go. My conversation with Blue Butterfield about Maine, a love story. I will say welcome. And tell me a little bit how you came to this book, because it's really special.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on, Michelle. It's really a pleasure and an honor. This has been a 3-year now project in the making, or I guess 2.5. But it started because I very much wanted to write. It just seemed like another way to express myself. And I'd been looking for an illustration project for a few years after doing a couple for Island Port Press back about 10 years ago. But really, because woodcuts are so time consuming, that really takes a lot of commitment. And so I wanted a text that really sang to me and felt special so that I could marshal that commitment to the images. And it seemed like the right text never quite came along. And then I started thinking about my own text. And as much as I love children's books and love young adult books, it seemed like I really wanted to write an adult book because that's what I wanted to write.
Yeah.
And so I was initially picturing it as these travel pieces because I love to adventure around Maine. I love to mountain bike and hike and run. And I thought it would be neat to talk about like the Maine huts and Katahdin and all these wonderful places that we have in Maine. And so that was what I was picturing the project to be. And of course, that's not what it ended up being, but that's what I was thinking. I ended up calling a good friend of mine who's a writer in Portland and asked if she knew anyone who could help me edit it, help me get into a writing group, help me, you know, one of the really good things about getting older is that you realize what you don't know and you need help.
Yeah, yeah.
And it feels really good now in my 50s to say, I have no idea what I'm doing. Like, help me.
Isn't it so freeing? I love that too. It's like, let's just do what we want to do. I need help for that. And so can I just ask if the fact that it came together in the past 2.5 to 3 years, you said?
Yeah.
I mean, that feels really fast to me.
I work on deadlines and I've seen now mothers write about it, and I didn't realize it was a thing until it happened to me, which is that when I had my first child, it made me work with intensity and concentration in a way that I had never done so before.
Right.
And that if I wanted to make art and I had an hour, you better make art.
Right. That makes sense to me, although I don't have kids. So maybe that's why I can let things sort of flounder on and on and on. So did you start the writing pieces that long ago or the woodcuts or both?
So the woodcuts, about 70% of them are woodcuts that I had made over the years, but they were very much attached to memories. They were attached to like very visceral places in my memory. So the connection wasn't difficult. So the whole project was about 2.5 years. So I started that in about April of 2021. And I reached out to Susan Conley, because that's who my friend directed me to, who's a wonderful writer and leads these incredible workshops and really teaching people the tools of the trade. I knew that I do well with deadlines. So I said, okay, every month I'm going to send you 2 essays in my travelogues. And she said, great. Okay. Bring them on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was a deadline.
Right. Right. No, that's good. And 2 essays a month or 2 travel pieces, that feels realistic to me actually. So hearing that the pieces were connected to woodcuts that already existed in reading it, I was wondering, how did you get these specific little sparks? So for a lot of them, they might've existed in the woodcuts already.
It really is a mix. A lot of them happened because of the writing. Mm. So it was a really delightful cross-pollination when I remembered, oh, I always wanted to capture this place or, you know, this feeling. And I just hadn't thought about actually making the piece. So there was certainly a back and forth between the two.
Yeah. And so tell me a little bit more about the woodcuts too. And how did you start getting involved in that artistically?
It was a long time ago, actually. It was in college, and we had a visiting art professor, history professor, which is really incredible, who is from California and happened to also be a renowned woodblock artist. His name's Tom Killian. He still does absolutely gorgeous full color printmaking in the traditional Japanese style, which is one block of wood for one color. So lots and lots and lots of carving. And he taught like about a week of printmaking at Bowdoin. And it's funny because I was floundering a little bit in that I loved art history. I did, you know, being surrounded by a lot of artists growing up, I certainly liked to draw, I liked to paint, but I really hadn't found something where it just spoke to me in such a deep way. And yeah. I loved the craftsmanship of it. I loved the tools. I loved the tool sharpening, like everything about it felt really right.
Yeah.
So I was for years, you know, when my children were very small, I would take my woodcuts out and take my tools and I could go to the playground and carve wood. And it felt like an easy way to just, you know, pull something out of my bag and start working on it.
Yeah.
And then in mid 2000s, I took a class with Don Gorvette, who was a reduction woodblock printmaker. Mm-hmm. And I'd always wanted to print with color. Before, I'd been printing black and whites and then hand coloring them. But I love the idea of printing with color so that your carving strokes with the chisels actually made color. But the idea of having one block for every color seemed insane to me. And it was, you know, just too much. You know, I didn't want 20 blocks of wood for one piece of art. So he has a method that was actually first discovered by Picasso in the 50s. Mm-hmm. He used it with linoleum of one block of wood and slowly carving away color by color, but printing that one block of wood on the same piece of paper over and over and over again, while you gradually reduce your printable areas, while you gradually carve the block away. And it sounds complicated. It's actually, because it's broken step by step, it's not terrible. And I just loved it. So I've been printing that way ever since.
Yeah. I had the pleasure of visiting you in your studio or at your press, which was super cool. And I kind of get it. I appreciate the fact that it's step by step, because I think that there's something about, as you were saying before, a slow process that appeals to me and that I think is like you only have to think about one part at a time.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was the like little spark that you thought I'd like to write?
I honestly think it had been in the back of my mind for a long time. You know, my best friend from high school is a writer. I love reading about writers. I love the idea of really delving into what you're thinking, you know, and because a lot of times you don't know. And I think that was what happened in this book, is that I didn't know what I was going to write until the travelogues didn't seem very interesting to me. And I was like, well, would I ever read this book? No. Okay. What do I want to write about that feels really real to me? And what it ended up being was not at all what I thought it would be. You know, I kind of slowly started picking apart, you know, an unusual childhood, a little bit of a atypical, disorganized, I don't know, however you want to put it, you know, of with artists and chaos and just pulling that apart a little bit. And it was really an incredible experience to find that narrative and find meaningful things in it, attached to the places in Maine.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not just a book of beautiful art, of beautiful woodcuts. The writing is gorgeous and equally compelling. And I've paged through the book many times. And first, I page through looking at the woodcuts and I go skip, skip, skip pages of text. Then I read the text and then I was like, skip, skip, skip woodblocks. Then you can also obviously pause, look at the pictures in between. And sometimes I feel like, oh, that was the picture we just saw. Mm-hmm. So they work together and independently so beautifully. Obviously, the big thing we haven't mentioned yet, I want you to tell a little bit about your childhood, because originally I was going to have you read something from earlier in your life. But I'd like to be able to share a little bit about your upbringing, because you write about some very wonderful things and some very difficult things. Those are the places my attention is drawn to, where there's so much mm-hmm. contrast. And Maine is a gorgeous, gorgeous place. And Maine can be a hard place too. And so I know you grew up on Mount Desert Island.
Correct.
Yeah. Do you want to tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think part of the unusualness that I didn't, again, maybe realize was unusual is that my parents were very, very young. My mom had dropped out of college. She was in the throes of, you know, free spirit, hippie, dropout culture. And they did not expect to have me. And both of her parents died the year I was born for different reasons. So she was very much adrift, but did have some inheritance. And so bought a farm in Bar Harbor. It's just a small inheritance. And they were very much, you know, still, I mean, they were in their early 20s, you know, so they were, you know, making houseboats that we were sleeping on and painting buses that we would go to bluegrass festivals on. One of their friends had, you know, filmed an 8mm camera. And so it was all these just 20 people in the house. And, you know, I'm the only kid and, you know, just very much chaos. And then when I was 5, it was actually the eve of my 6th birthday. My dad was biking in near Bar Harbor and he got hit by a car and suffered a traumatic brain injury, as well as a, you know, just terrible physical injuries. He broke both his legs, his spine, his skull fractured. He was in the hospital for months. And he was never the same afterwards. So that viewed through that lens of childhood, it was an odd thing to have someone very much change their personality in a very short period of time. And so I didn't know exactly how to process that. And unfortunately, as what often happens now that I work in medicine and I see it, is that folks after head injuries have real anger. I think it's just, you know, truly chemical. They just can't control their anger. So my parents fought and fought and fought. And that was probably the most harmful, I think, just because for 2 years, it was just constant fighting. And so then when he actually just left and he just drove and drove and drove until he got to California and stopped there. But then I could, I think, get back to my childhood because, you know, there wasn't this presence of, you know, of such stress.
Right, so. Right. Well, I'm so sorry because that sounds really difficult. And to be only 5 when that happens, to your earlier point, we don't even know what's normal, not normal when we're that young. And so, I mean, I will also say the child of 2 very young parents, someone who wasn't necessarily expected. A very different story. Like, stories have a lot of similarities and a lot of differences. Your name is Blue. That was the name your parents gave you.
Correct.
And I love the hippie stuff. My name is Michelle because let's think. There was a year when that was a really popular song. It's sort of we're at opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of the type of name you could get around that time. And so in my small high school class, I think we had at least a dozen Michelles. So I have always been one of very many Michelles. But yeah, you were also around a lot of art.
Yeah, my mother's an artist and she was a boutique artist when I was younger. She also made like Ukrainian eggs, which is very similar actually to batiks. It's that wax resist and then dye the next color. And in some ways it does, it's sort of like reduction, but it's not really, but it has some similarities. And then as she got older, she started making more like cardboard dioramas, like Day of the Dead, kind of, you know, very intricate dioramas. And there was a lot of artists around, friends around. So there was definitely a lot of art and a lot of books and a lot, you know, and so again, that to me, this whole processing how my childhood went, to me, that was really the wonderful part, was that there was so, so much opportunity to make art and so much opportunity to read, you know, in
right,
my house.
Right, right. So, what did you read when you were little?
Well, the house was full of paperbacks. And it's funny because this golden age of YA literature did not exist then. So,
right.
So actually, I was reading all sorts of really unusual books that were just on the shelf there. And I remember I found A Prayerful and Meanie. And I love that book, like passionately, but I was, I was pretty young, you know, to, but it was when you're an only child on a mile long dirt road, you know, that's what you, you spend a lot of time reading. And I love Italo Calvino's Italian Fairy Tales. It's like this 600, 700 page, you know, book of where he translates all these Italian folk tales. And I really love that as well.
Are they at all like the, any of the fairy tales that we kind of more commonly know of?
They are and they aren't. They're not really Brothers Grimm. They're much more like farm-based, which I probably really appeal to me too, because it was so much of like these, you know, people who worked on farms and you know, what happened to them.
Well, that sounds delightful. I read a lot of Judy Blume. So, and I don't know. And Laura Ingalls Wilder. Those were kind of like two of my standouts. I would always imagine if Laura Ingalls, if I could bring her into my current 1970s, you know, world, I'd show her what a light switch was and then we'd go drive in the car. That was my little fantasy about that.
But my mother loves Laura Ingalls Wilder. And I think I almost didn't want to read them. I mean, I did read a few of them, but I almost didn't want to read them because I, it was kind of a protest. I'm like, look, you just want to live like they did. I mean, you, here you are like homesteading and farming and, you know, just.
Yeah. And you had a garden and you did a lot of planting. And did you feel like the art or any of that early childhood lifestyle, maybe the after the fighting stopped, did that influence you in terms of like you thinking about what you wanted to do when you quote unquote grew up, you know?
I certainly didn't really think art would be a part of my future. I mean, I very much, I was thinking, okay, I want to be a lawyer, I want to be a doctor, I want to be, you know, some, something that can, you know, not feel so poverty stricken, you know, not feel like so much of an outlier, you know? But I did like doing it. And because when people are doing art and kids are around, they always end up doing something. And so I remember making not just the art, but it's actually the creation of something. Like you have an idea and then you, you make it. And of course it never quite looks how you imagine it's going to, but that deep satisfaction of finding something, you know, that you were going, you want to, I remember making these paper dolls when I was a kid and I'm like, okay, I want them to have different outfits. So I made this little sliding paper where I could change her outfits by drawing all these little outfits and then just slide them along her head. You know what I mean? Like,
I had paper dolls too. I got the ones that you cut out and you like fold little tabs. So I love that when you started writing, it wasn't what you thought you were going to write. I am also learning the thing we, I thought I might write about is maybe not what I will write about. I'm kind of still thinking about that. But when you did start and you sort of were feeling your way towards what you thought it was going to be, how did that process work? I know you worked with Susan Connolly and did she push you a lot or like what was the evolution of those pieces?
Well, you know, it's actually, I mean, because you're, when you start pushing into or just pushing emotion, it gets really scary. And I had gone back to my mother's farm because I thought she was going to sell her house. And I started just kind of walking around it and I wrote the piece, which is actually the first piece in the book. And it's kind of like, if you give a moose a muffin, it's called If You Give a Girl an Outhouse, actually. So I wrote that piece just kind of in one sitting as I come up. And I'd been writing for like a year at that point, but it was felt very different from other pieces in a really scary way. And I sent it to Susan and she wrote back. She was like, yes, like this is what, like more emotion, more, you know, I mean, she's an incredibly positive teacher, which is funny because I initially was like, oh, she's too nice. She's too positive. I need more like, you know, I need people to just be like, this is terrible.
What's not working? It doesn't help when they say this is great.
Right. Exactly. But in the end, obviously I realized that she was incredibly good at encouraging you to do the things that she thought were working well. And also, you know, she would just say things like, what did it look like? Or, you know, what were you feeling then? Or, you know, just a way of like trying to get you into the scene more. And that was really helpful for me too, again, as a new writer.
Yeah.
Just trying to find my footing because I love to read, but I just had never thought about the workings of reading. I mean, of writing as much. I mean, I've written some in college, except, but not, you know, right. not to this level.
Yeah. It is scary. Like the minute we get to the really, that's why I call this Daring to Tell, because it's really hard. It's really scary.
Yeah. No, no question. That first piece, one of the processes of it that is, I really have my family to thank for, is that with almost every essay, at least two or three times a week, my husband or my sons would say, "Hey, what are you writing right now? And will you read it to me?" I mean, what an act of generosity to just say, "Oh yeah, please just read me what you're writing." So I read my husband that first piece, and I actually like started crying after I read it to him out loud. It was like, I was like, "Oh, I didn't know I was going to go there." Like, you know, and he was just, you know, kind of held me and was like, "This is really a beautiful piece." And I was like, "Oh, I mean, I wasn't sure what to make of it." So it was incredible to have that reassurance.
And when those tears come, especially by surprise, you're like, "Oh, Jesus Christ. I didn't know this was going to, I guess this does mean something to me."
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. I feel like we can't not hear any. Let's. So if you want to start with the chapter called The Sacred and Mundane, and then we're going to continue through the next chapter called Disoriented.
Gotcha.
Whenever you are ready.
The Sacred and Mundane. I had a nightmare last night. I said to Toby, "Ugh," he said, "dreams are so boring." He and I were stuffed into the way back of Professor McKean's Volvo station wagon, along with four others in the back seat, on our way to Freeport for our college photography class. I rolled my eyes and pushed on. "Too bad, you're getting it anyway." So I was like 40 years old and I was married and I had four kids. And I had married a guy, but he was really some sort of demon. And every night I had to have dinner ready on the table by 5 o'clock. But somehow every night it would be like quarter of and I hadn't even started. And then he would start screaming and these slits would open over his eyes and his face would turn bright red. It was terrible. Now Toby was smirking at me. And it was like all my 20s and 30s had just disappeared and I was middle-aged. I sighed, remembering the horror and how happy I'd been to wake up in my dorm room. "Okay, that was actually funny," Toby said, chuckling along with the others in the car. It didn't feel funny, though. It had left me with a terrible memory of a lost life. The previous week, Professor McKean had assigned us Nicholson Baker's The Mezzanine, an entire book of one man's journey up an escalator and all his thoughts about his office supplies and shoelaces. Somehow it worked. It was funny and engrossing, and the teaching point was obvious. With enough attention and skill, an artist can make anything interesting. While I loved the book and was deeply impressed by the author's abilities, I had a hard time imagining that this was something I could do, make the mundane sing. And watching the newly green hayfields and rocky coast unspool behind us, I wondered why it was necessary. We were in Maine, after all, surrounded by natural beauty everywhere we looked. Why try and capture anything else? Once I had gotten over the newness of college, of living with so many other young adults, a library open until midnight, and ice cream available every day in the cafeteria, I had come to realize something else about myself there. I truly love learning, not just to please adults and my teachers, but because so many of the things I was taking in felt like they might become an essential part of me, that this knowledge might be fundamental to who I wanted to become. That year alone, I discovered how much I liked inorganic chemistry and the perfection of the periodic table, the detective work in physics class of graphing the paths of quarks and mesons in the particle accelerator, and the pleasures of art history. I'd been surrounded by art and artists my whole life, but had never learned any of its evolution and found myself swept up in the narrative. Everything from the color woodcuts of the Han Dynasty to medieval illuminated manuscripts and the precise interiors of Jan van Eyck and the Dutch Renaissance. The particulars all felt so personal and faded, like I was meant to know them. I tried it all on like changes of clothing, enveloped in this rapturous feeling of curiosity and expansion. That afternoon, after we got to Freeport, Toby and I wandered around Wolf's Neck Park with Professor McKean and his one instruction: find the magic in the ordinary. Toby quickly took to this assignment, taking pictures of his shoes in a field of rotting apples from the previous fall. I left him there to wander deeper into the woods behind the orchard. Another new experience for me that year was a visceral and panicky fear of death. It appeared so suddenly. Was it because I was now arriving in adulthood and finding independence that I began to feel my mortality so acutely? Perhaps all these new friends and heady experiences had made my existence so rich that it now occurred to me how terrible it would be to lose it all. For whatever the reason, I found myself gasping in the middle of the night, crying and full of terror of what inevitably lay ahead. I didn't think about it during the day, walking from lunch to my microbiology class or running on the track. It was only alone at night that I felt this horror and great sadness of such impending loss. Sometimes I would get out of bed and sit in front of the mirror and draw myself to feel present and grounded and try and leave the anxiety behind. Earlier that spring, a visiting history professor named Tom Killian had come to campus from California. He was also a woodblock printmaker of exquisite Western landscapes, sequoias and mountain ranges in the traditional multi-block Japanese style. He spent a week with the printmaking department showing us how to carve blocks of wood with stainless steel tools in a variety of shapes, from V-gouges a few millimeters wide to great U-shaped scoops. He then taught us how to roll them with ink and print them on an etching bed. We started with pine blocks and razor blades to cut our images. I had a terrible time of it at first, and my hands were soon covered in bloody nicks. But as the week went on and I became more proficient, I found a deep satisfaction in carving the shapes around objects. I love sculpting and finding the image in the wood and the surprise and delight in the transition from wood to paper. So much of it was about negative space, the area between objects. I wanted to cut the triangle between a bent arm and a torso, the spaces between tree branches, the shape of what was not. And something about finding the objects by finding the space around it felt so deeply right. I tried to complete the assignment that afternoon in Freeport. I really did. I photographed an old tractor with tiny front wheels and huge back ones like my dad used to drive. I snapped pictures of rusty oil drums in the woods. But it all felt a little phony, trying to capture something that didn't really speak to me. As I made my way closer to the shore, I saw the mackerel sky over the water, a cloud formation I have always loved. Down on the stony amphitheater over the bay, the tide pools reflected the sky's color, a shimmering lapis lazuli of illuminated manuscripts. I bent over the pools, remembering the joy of this childhood activity, and was richly rewarded. There were barnacles open to the water, like little fronds waving in the breeze. Periwinkles crawling slowly along the bottom, and tiny translucent shrimp scuttling under the floating seaweed. And the longer I looked, the more things I found. A tiny starfish pressed to the side of the granite, an antennaed sea slug, and so many other living things that I couldn't identify but wanted to. These little worlds were so full of life, they felt worthy of notice, a sacred thing. This is what I ended up photographing, trying to capture as many inhabitants of the tide pool that I could fit in one frame. And I recognized that this act of focus was in and of itself soothing. It reminded me of how I felt carving wood. It took the attention away from myself and my worries of mortality and what lay in my future, and put it squarely on trying to find the hidden narratives, the delight in creation, these rewards of attention. Disoriented. Instructions from my panel of patients. Do not overstimulate Dot. Announce yourself loudly when you knock on Harry's door. Do not tell Herb his wife is dead. Do not try to orient Nina. Oriented is a new word for me. It means understanding your context to the world, the who, where, and when you are. In dementia, you lose the when first, then the where, and finally the who. My first patient was Esther, who was described in her chart as pleasantly demented. "It's so good to see you again," she exclaimed as I walked into her room. We had never met before. She reached out to hold my hand. Her skin was soft and papery thin. It felt fragile as tissue paper. I sat down in the bed next to her and admired a picture on her bedside table, a handsome middle-aged woman sitting on a picnic bench in front of a campsite. Her confident smirk at the camera was so startlingly different from this woman who gazed at me now and smiled hopefully, as if trying to conjure the right answers. My next patient, Al, was aphasic. He spoke not a word. His face was emotionless and flat, but his eyes flickered to mine as I chatted to him about his clothing choices and what was for breakfast in the dining room. I pondered what his mind held as I shaved his face, buttoned his Oxford shirt, and attached a wide canvas belt to his waist so I could help him stand before we slowly shuffled together to the dining room. How had I come to this work? I had always enjoyed speculating about my future, trying on different careers, when friends of my mom asked, "I think I want to be an art therapist. I'm considering being a lawyer. I think I want to be a doctor." But the future was now, and I had no idea how to pay my undergraduate student loans, let alone support myself. I needed a skill, something that offered more security than seasonal work in Bar Harbor. My mom, who had faced her own financial difficulties, had become a nurse while I was in high school. She suggested I become a physician assistant, another 2 years of study, rather than figure out how I could possibly borrow the money for 4 years of medical school. Ironically, to apply to these graduate programs necessitated medical work experience, exactly what I was hoping to gain from the degree. So I had completed the 6-week training course, the shortest I could find to become a certified nursing assistant, and found myself fresh out of college, working at a nursing home dementia ward. Here, I cleaned patients, dressed them, and fed them. Light flickered off Bubble Pond, creating a strobe light through the trees as I ran past. The sweet smell of leaf litter was strong, and I felt an ache of nostalgia. This bright October afternoon reminded me of so many other days, just like it, that I had spent running with the other girls on the cross-country team. I felt it everywhere, from the crackle of leaves under my sneakers to the long ribbons of light across the gravel road and the trees gaudy and aflame. The carriage paths of Acadia were perfect for my aimless runs. I started at Witch Hole, a circular route that wound around rock ledges of low bush blueberries and ponds where the occasional beaver would slap the water in warning as I passed. At every intersection, a collection of wooden arrows pointed to new places like Paradise Hill and Eagle Lake. Every new sign was a decision to make, and all I could think was to run farther. So I had left Witch Hole and traveled under the peaked granite bridge of Eagle Lake before another sign and inspiration sent me towards Jordan Pond. The long downhill path to the water was bordered with irregular pink granite coping stones. On the right side of the road was a landslide of boulders that appeared to have halted mid-avalanche. To the left lay an expansive view of the pond and Bubble and Pemetic Mountains behind it. The beauty of it all made my chest surge. It seemed impossible that I was not returning to college that fall and that all my friends had dispersed around the country since graduation. Growing up, I knew little of privileged spaces, but I recognized it in my small liberal arts college immediately. My first day on campus featured a welcome lobster picnic under a white tent with tablecloths and real silverware, giant blocks of cheese, and artfully arranged fruit. I was used to feeling like an outsider and felt those familiar anxieties talking to my new classmates with old money names and tailored clothing while I stood in my denim skirt and flip-flops. But instead, something magical happened. For reasons I still don't entirely understand, my strangeness was no longer a liability. I was unique. I made friends with students who seemed nonplussed about my love of epic fantasy and lack of nice clothes. We debated the merits of Madonna songs while drinking shandies and playing hearts. We hosted Friday night dance parties and rode stone lions outside the art museum. We played 3-on-3 basketball late at night in an old unused gymnasium where the security guard asked us to lock up after we left. Now, I was back home on Mount Desert Island because I didn't know where else to go. My friends had all moved on to New York or Chicago to start work in publishing houses, nonprofits, and executive training. I couldn't imagine holding any of these jobs. How did they get them? I had no skills beyond waiting tables and lacked the confidence to pretend I did. How are my college classes supposed to prepare me for those careers? And how would I have dressed for such a job interview? I felt like this was some crucial piece of education I had missed. Where would I find professional clothes, and how would I afford them? I wore running tights or shorts and a sweatshirt, and for work, the stiff white uniform dresses I had found at Kmart and Ellsworth. Some of the nursing home residents had retained their speech but were caught in an endless cycle of anxious questions. "When is Carol coming? Have you seen my watch? When am I going home?" Ruby asked me as I bathed her. "Oh, and when is Carol coming?" Suddenly, in a lucid moment, she grabbed my arm. "Did I just ask you that question?" She looked at me intently. Her voice was pitched high and full of anguish. I tried to reassure her that she had not, and then I held her hand and cooed, like I would to a baby, not knowing what else to do. To my surprise, she calmed and squeezed my hand, the whole conversation quickly forgotten. I ran from Hadlock Pond to Pemetic Mountain and the Amphitheater Bridge, a long asymmetric span of multifarious stone that made up the road's switchback turn and vaulted over a small stream. Something compelled me to stop and feel the cool granite cap. I didn't always feel euphoric from these long runs, but I did feel smooth, like my nerve endings had been combed into relaxation. I edged my way down to the stream, which ran below the bridge, and stared up at its peaking arch. It was a marvel of architecture and artistry. Made during the Great Depression, it must have given those who worked on it great pride to build something of such grace and function, something beautiful from all angles that sat perfectly woven with maple and birch trees. Something a directionless young woman could sit on 60 years later that felt entirely solid and ancient, as if it had always been there. At that moment of exhaustion and overwhelmed with beauty, the world made sense, and I felt soothed and peaceful. My mom's boyfriend once told me, "Anyone who runs more than 5 miles at a time is running away from something." He was a doctor. He was probably right. All my toenails had turned varying degrees of red and purple and black. I found the transformation fascinating. Years later, at a road race, I would see someone wearing a "Got Toenails" t-shirt and realize something comforting. That, as with most things in life, my experience was not unique. Vita's bedtime routine was prolonged and strange. She was a thin, elderly woman with a halo of white curls and oversized glasses. Remarkably spry, she wandered the halls with a grace that belied her age, but she had forgotten the purpose of most things in her room. She stared at her toothbrush, perplexed, and tied long socks around her head like a headband. The ritual of getting her to bed could take over an hour as she questioned the purpose and manner of operation of pajamas and face cloths and mouthwash. Sometimes I just sat there watching as she softly brushed her arms with her hairbrush, murmuring to herself, it was best not to rush her. One night, after a particularly long ordeal of coaxing her into her pajamas and a protracted discussion about why her clothes from the day went into the laundry basket, I finally got her into bed. She was fretful about the pillows that I kept readjusting to some perfect alignment that only she could judge. But then she looked at her bedside touch lamp and her eyes softened, and I saw it. She was suddenly at peace, all anxieties forgotten. She turned to me, her face golden and shining in the lamplight. "I don't know what I'd do if it weren't for that lamp. Go ahead and touch it, on and off, just like that." Her smile was beatific. And I smiled back at her, perplexed why only this lamp was decipherable, but still joyful for her moment of happiness and lucidity. The world temporarily made sense.
Thank you. My voice gave out there. Thank you. One of the things I'm most struck by in your writing are these juxtapositions of really tough things and really beautiful things and really confusing things and really lucid things. And is that intentional?
No, I mean, I think it's funny. Actually, for this piece, I actually was reading some of my journals from that time. And I journaled pretty extensively when I was younger. And I couldn't get over this feeling of, you know, here you are, like just out of college, and it sounds like it should be this lovely time of your life, right? You're healthy, you're young, but, you know, and obviously I was plagued some by money worry, so that created its own anxiety. But yeah, it just really took me back to that time where you don't know how to soothe yourself. You know, this was before the internet, where I didn't understand how the world worked. I didn't understand that why my friends were getting these fabulous jobs. I didn't realize it was because they came from money and connections. And
I know.
So I just thought it was some inadequacy of mine that I couldn't figure out how to make it. But here I was on Mountain Island, which is one of, you know, those carriage paths are just stunningly beautiful.
Yeah.
And so it really was a time where I ran constantly, like sometimes 18 miles, just because I kind of didn't know what else to do with myself. It was a way of self-soothing, a lot of ways that art is too, you know, of
yeah. And sometimes we don't even know that we're doing it. Do you think? I don't know. I feel like that recognition is sort of going back to the Wolf's Neck, which I know a little better than I know Mount Desert Island, but you're like, okay, I'm going to try and take this picture of something. And it's the forced kind of fake, like this tractor. But then when you see the thing, like, oh, tide pool, there's just not even a hesitation. It's like something opens up. And I think we can sometimes be more conscious or self-conscious about the things that don't work and sort of forget ourselves at all with the things that do. I don't know.
Well, when we were talking about reading this piece earlier today, and it brought up this David Brooks quote that I love. It was from a short story, I think, in the Atlantic or New Yorker. And I just want, it's just a few lines. I just wanted to read to you because it, sure. I so much think about this now because I think my whole life is just trying to get in the river, as he talks about now. Now, though, I see things differently. I believe we inherit a great river of knowledge, a flow of patterns coming from many sources. The information that comes from deep in the evolutionary past, we call genetics. The information passed along from hundreds of years ago, we call culture. The information passed along from decades ago, we call family. And the information offered months ago, we call education. But it is all information that flows through us. The brain is adapted to the river of knowledge and exists only as a creature in that river. Our thoughts are profoundly molded by this long historic flow, and none of us exists self-made in isolation from it. And though history has made us self-conscious in order to enhance our survival prospects, we still have deep impulses to erase the skull lines in our head and become immersed directly in the river. I've come to think that flourishing consists of putting yourself in situations in which you lose self-consciousness and become fused with other people, experiences, or tasks. It happens sometimes when you're lost in a hard challenge or when an artist or a craftsman becomes one with a brush or tool. It happens sometimes when you're playing sports or listening to music or lost in a story, or to some people when they feel enveloped by God's love. And it happens most when we connect with other people. I've come to think that happiness isn't really produced by conscious accomplishments. Happiness is a measure of how thickly the unconscious parts of our minds are intertwined with other people and with activities. That's enough of it. But I love that quote.
That is amazing.
Because it really does speak to that we are trying to get into our subconscious and sort of lose ourselves in whatever we're doing. And that's what makes that was what makes me happy, certainly. And that's what I look for in art.
Yeah.
I feel like it's harder now in the world of screens and phones and, you know, to separate yourself and then be lost, but still obtainable. It just takes a lot more work.
It really does. And in a certain regard, I feel that way very much. And one of the other things you mentioned is about growing up privileged. And I was thinking in a certain regard, you grew up with a beautiful type of privilege, which is the beauty of Maine. And I don't know. That's
absolutely. That, I mean, to me, that was the best part of the project. Well, the best part of the project really was sharing with my husband and being able to like have him listen to these pieces because it was so intimate.
Yes.
And it was also just fulfilled some sort of fantasy of like life of letters that I always wanted to leave. But the other best part was that I suddenly, I think, again, I'd always just assigned my childhood to a lack of privilege and of defined it by what I didn't have.
Yeah.
And instead of really thinking about, wow, it gave me a ability to entertain myself and to appreciate nature and, you know, and be by myself. And those are really wonderful things that I would not trade.
Exactly. Exactly. And I do think that it's the mark of maturity that we come to say, there were some really horrible things and there were some really beautiful things, and your innate drive to jump into that flow again in whatever ways that you could, because obviously you were doing that before you read this quote, you know, so really, I mean, that's very recognizable because of that's what it is. And I think for many people who seek some sort of creative expression, I can relate to that too, in a sound sense, I guess, because that's the area that I most have found sure. that immersion, and also writing, because we can get there. Sometimes you're like trying to get there. And that's the right. other thing. It's like the really trying versus something opening up, and how that's a constant, like, ugh, can I just get there? Like, what are the little, I hate the word tricks, but you know, what are the tools that we can get ourselves closer towards that state? Because the other thing that I was greatly drawn to in your story was you talking about in college, the periodic table and chemistry. And so you had a lot of sciencey stuff going on as well as this art stuff. And those were both seeds in what would happen for you. And I am really drawn to the fact that your first or one of your very first jobs was working with dementia patients, which takes mm-hmm. tremendous skill, bravery, fortitude, all of those things. What was that like for you? Because that's just such a beautiful scene of your patience and kindness with people who are don't know how hard they're having it.
It was definitely a, you know, culture shock coming from my little liberal arts school too, because it's not just the patients. It's also, you know, there's lots of people there who have worked there for 30 years. And so that a really kind of different cultural feel for me. And a lot of sadness, because there was, I don't know, when I saw people really struggling to, when they recognized that they were not remembering something, I mean, that was particularly anxiety full for me. I mean, I felt terribly for these patients, and I had never cleaned elderly bodies. I had never dressed people and, you know, and seen people so vulnerable. And I think it really immensely influenced my work as a practitioner, because I'm very grateful for other people's work, and I never order things that I do not need, because I've done those tasks and I know that, you know, what a hard thing it is.
Can I ask was that any part of your training, how to clean and care for people in some of those most basic ways?
That was what the CNA's training was. I mean, I'm a physician assistant now, which is a provider. So I see patients and write prescriptions and that sort of thing. So, and I just work in the hospital. So it's a very different, but no, we spend a lot of time, you know, how to safely move people, how to clean people, how to, you know, so there was certainly some training around it, but it was just not training I had ever really thought about or experienced before.
Right. And I'm sure back in those CNA days that was really like, okay, now we're going to really put that in action. You know, I mean, that's got to be intimidating. And
Oh, sure. No, I mean, your first patient where you're like, wow, I'm going to change someone in bed and, you know, put diapers on them and, you know what I mean? Yeah. For a 22-year-old, it was definitely like, whoa, okay.
Yeah.
But again, it's also not an experience I would trade now, even though at the time I was like, wow, I have friends who are working in banking in Mexico City. And
So obviously there was the financial directive to, you know, I need to get a job that I can pay back student loans or take care of myself, find a place to live, all those basic things. But was the fact that you liked chemistry, did that all seem like an obvious choice for you? Because obviously you had a lot of ideations when you were younger too.
It seemed like a good fit to me. You know, initially I was thinking I'd actually, right after being a CNA, I worked in an ER in Bar Harbor, and the physician assistants there actually ran the ER. And I was watching them in action. They're incredible. They're running codes. They're, you know, they're stabilizing trauma. They're sending to Bangor. And I'm like, wow, I could learn this in 2 years. Of course, what I didn't realize is that both of them were like ex-Vietnam medics who, you know, like had then gone on to become PAs.
Yeah.
And so they had incredible amount of skill. So that was sort of what I was thinking I was going to want to do. But fairly quickly, the emergency side of things, like really, I did work in emergency medicine for a couple of years, but I really didn't enjoy the stress of it. And I couldn't calm down when I got home. Like I would be just so still vibrating, you know, post shift.
Yeah.
So I had also rotated at Leahy Clinic for internal medicine. Internal medicine is really a really interesting field for someone who just had, because you can spend a little more time thinking about something, and certainly with hospital medicine, some time talking to people. you know, it's not a 15-minute appointment. I can spend 2 hours talking with someone and trying to sort out what's really going on, you know, when they're in the hospital. The ER knows they're sick, they say they need to be admitted, and then I get to actually like spend some real time thinking about the patients. And I really like that detective work,
yeah,
a real connection with a person, and then, you know, really wanting to help people. I mean, and it seemed like a good fit for me.
I love that. Mm-hmm. I love the idea. I mean, I think that that might have been a fun job if I even had thought that that was something that I could do, which it wasn't, but I'm sort of musing about all these things that are components and trying to feel how they fit together. But have you felt like all of the pieces form this whole, like, do the wood blocks fit in to making you a better physician assistant?
Oof. To me, it always seemed more of a way to, because it can be quite stressful at the hospital. And so it was kind of more of a way to compress.
Yeah, that's one way.
It's funny because even though I would say, like, I certainly wasn't disciplined at 20 the way I'm disciplined now, but I feel like working on woodcuts has greatly, in a good way, increased my discipline because tools need to be sharpened, prints need to be additioned in a very exact, precise way. And I think that order appeals to me, even as it goes along with the experimentation, you know, with art and trying new things. I still love that I can fall back to, all right, I need to sharpen these tools. I need to, you know, because you have to do that fairly frequently to carve wood. Yeah. And I think I just really like that dichotomy, you know, the two things converging.
Right. And I can see that even being a process in medicine too, that there are physical things, you know, these are all skills and endeavors that exist in the physical world. And right. I think that there's something about the tactile, like I'm going to sharpen this tool, right. that your brain does slow down a little bit and mm-hmm. that you are immersed in this physical world that allows you then to be more present when you move on. So
it's true. I mean, what I truly loved about emergency medicine is that it's very procedural. So like you're sewing up people a lot, you're doing a lot of procedures.
Yeah.
And I like working my hands. I'm pretty dexterous from years and years of doing stuff. And so I loved, in probably that same way of like entering the river, I love sewing people up. I loved like pulling splinters out and doing it, I mean, and creatively trying to figure out how to get a fish hook out of someone's hand or like that was really fun.
I say, set you up for having two boys later on, I guess. Right.
Exactly. But maybe that was why it worked even better with internal medicine because I wasn't getting that procedural experience. So I had to do it at home.
Well, I'm entranced. I think it's all. I think it's all. I know I'm being a little. I don't mean to embarrass you, but it all comes together so beautifully. And okay, so I have two more official questions. So I'll try and be a little more open ended. What do you love most about Maine?
It's an interesting question. So, obviously, the accessibility of seeing beautiful places because there's. You can easily get to gorgeous state parks, gorgeous forests within, you know, I live in Portland and in 10 minutes in either direction, I can be in some completely different scenery. And so that accessibility in nature is, I did not realize what a privilege it was until I started traveling the world and realizing that most places do not have it. And there's an emphasis, even though there is real class differences here in Maine, probably more and more as years go on, at least when I was growing up, there wasn't this like gated community. People weren't trying to limit people's access to beautiful places. And so I really love that about Maine and that you met all walks of life in Acadia, at Katahdin, at Tumbledown Mountain, you know, they're just, and that Northern, Southern Mainers, you know, everyone can appreciate this, the gorgeousness of it.
And I will say, as someone who spent the vast majority of her life in Massachusetts and, you know, Maine was accessible and I came up here from time to time, but I have had trouble articulating what it is about Maine that is just so breathtaking. And there's so many people that come here from other places. I love meeting someone who is you're from Maine. You're everyone's official definition of a Mainer. Like, you know, I was sort of like, I will be happy forever to be defined as from away. That's fine by me. It means I'm in Maine. But anyways.
Well, and the other thing is that even though that lots and lots of people come here, you can still be by yourself if you want to. You know, there are still places in Acadia where you can hike. If you, you know, if you're able to hike a mile, you can be by yourself on a ledge. So that's pretty rare too.
Yeah, that was one of the things I thought about it. It's like I was bombarded with people all the time, and you'd come to Maine and you'd be in a big traffic jam, but then you go to wherever you're going and it's like you pretty much be alone. And it is pretty astounding. Like there's just so much space, and it's beautiful space. And yeah. And again, I know I keep saying this, you capture it so beautifully. The woodcuts are just gorgeous. Thank you. And so my final question, what was most daring about this book for you?
Well, it certainly had things in it that I did not. In fact, I actually, when I wrote to Susan, when I first emailed her, I said, look, I love like Mary Carr's, like The Liar's Club, or, you know, but there's no way I ever want to write like anything like that, because I'm, you know, have a community of people here in Portland that know me and do not know these stories about my life. And I don't really want to confirm them, but it's funny, having written them, I actually felt it was really freeing, because I didn't feel like I had anything to hide. You know, like this is what happened. And I don't know why I felt like I had to hide it before, because I can't tell you the number of people who come to me and said, I did not know this about you after they'd read the book. And I was like, well, I didn't exactly share it. You know, so, and I didn't know that I wanted to share it, honestly, but I felt better for the sharing, I guess I should. There was just going to say there was something wonderful about feeling like you weren't hiding.
Yeah. You must have gotten all kinds of feedback from people you don't know about it.
I have. And it's been really interesting. I've had some really lovely letters. Many people have written to me about how they've been reading it out loud with their partner. Oh. And I really like that, because I love to read out loud with my husband. And I don't feel like I really understand a work until I read it out loud.
Yeah.
So it was such a fun process for me, for us to read. But even for anything, we'll read anything aloud. So that was really exciting to hear people reading it out loud. Also, that it did resonate, though, with a lot of Mainers who had that, or it had some experience in a place where they, you know, they recognized or, you know, felt the magic of that place. And so that was really lovely, too.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else you want to say, like your thoughts about the book overall, or any of your work or what you've shared? Because it's really, I'm so excited to have gotten the chance to get to know you a little bit, truly.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Shell. No, it was such a pleasure to be to speak with you. And it was fun to try and make sense of things. So thank you.
Looking into our pasts is often not for the faint of heart. After this conversation with Blue Butterfield and listening again to me thinking about the woodblock carvings and the beauty of Maine, and then going back to that essay she opens the book with, I glimpsed a deeper rawness of that childhood. She wanted to be a doctor or a lawyer so she wouldn't have to be poor anymore. Sometimes I have a way of looking right over and past the obvious. Please, oh please, check out this book. Every time I open it, I continue to get lost in the sceneries that she brings us to. It's a way to see Maine if you've never been here before, and if you have, well, you've gotten a taste of the big open spaces, the smell of pine or of ocean. And it is a way to keep a little piece of Maine on your end table or by your bedside. You have made it to the end of another Daring to Tell episode. Click that little plus button in your podcast app to make sure new episodes will pop in when I release them on the first Tuesday of each month. Maybe you'll share with a friend or a writing class or a book group. I also have a newsletter, which I call The Redo, my own little essay or story that I release each month. Sign up for it at my freshly updated website, michellerado.com. Thank you, as always, to my husband, Phil Rado, for his music. And today, for our fun little drum roll that we had at the top of the show, I'll bring it back again because, by the way, another Daring to Tell alum is also an MWPA finalist in the nonfiction category. that is Gretchen Charrington. For her book, The Butcher, The Embezzler, and The Fall Guy, a family memoir of scandal and greed in the meat industry. Congratulations, Gretchen. Thank you for making it to the end of another episode. I will leave you with another Phil Rado composition, which I think fits pretty nicely with today's episode. Catch you next month.
It isn't hidden in the seascape. It's not about the state we're in. It's almost like a secret. It's a real sky. We found a real sky. There was nothing on the mountain or any valley we've been in. Summer's come around again with a real sky. We found a real sky. I felt the wind blow from all directions now. I felt the fog roll from east to west. I've been a sailboat on the ocean, and the wind may blow me a different way towards home. It has nothing to do with heaven, nothing to do with righting wrongs. Winter gathers fury with a real sky. We found a real sky. Nothing on the pages, all the books that line the shelf. There are no hidden meanings in a real sky. And we found a real sky. I felt the wind blow from all directions now. I felt the fog roll from east to west. And I've been a sailboat on the ocean. And the wind may blow me a different way towards home. It isn't hidden in the seascape. Not about the state we're in. It's almost like a secret. It's a real sky. We found a real sky. We found a real sky.